didn't. Morning. First thing I want to do is apologize to everybody. I think it was a wrong call to ask you all to come this morning, and much more dangerous than we had predicted yesterday. So thank you for all being here, and we assume the call on this case will be right, whichever side. So I'll now call our first case, 09AP956CR, State v. Donovan M. Boris. Representing the state of Wisconsin is Maura F.J. Whelan. If I might just hold a minute, I want to thank Rachel, who is the law clerk for Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, for playing Marshall today. We got a call, Rachel, from Wisconsin. Is that to put on the amplifier microphones? Okay. Okay. All right. Okay, so you're in charge of red, orange, and green. Okay? Whelan? You're in charge of the podium at the moment.
Please the court. I'm Maura Whelan, appear on behalf of the state of Wisconsin, assuming I'm reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. A couple of opening remarks. The state asks this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and reinstate Donovan Barris's conviction for first-degree reckless injury. The legal question presented today is whether the trial court correctly instructed the jury on the place of after-the-fact conduct and the utter disregard for human life analysis. The trial court instructed the jury by quoting this court's decision in State v. Jensen, a case that directly addressed the question. Jensen correctly states the law on how after-the-fact conduct should be considered in the utter disregard analysis. The trial court gave the jury an instruction based on that correct statement of the law. Nevertheless, the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded for a new trial, finding that this legally correct instruction, drawn from verbatim from this Court's Jensen opinion, had a reasonable likelihood of misleading the jury in an unconstitutional manner. The Court of Appeals' theory is that the instruction improperly denigrated the defendant's after-the-fact expression of remorse. The Court was wrong. Analyzing prior law, Jensen said that the defendant's later conduct is less significant than his conduct before and during the infliction of the injury.
Just so we understand this, your position that you want this court to adopt is that later conduct is of less significance, and that's how the jury should have been instructed. Is that right?
The state is not asking the court to adopt a new rule of law.
I didn't say no. I gave you a summary of what I thought you think is the existing rule.
That is what I think the existing law is.
Existing rule is, and now state, please.
Yeah, the state believes that the existing rule of law under Jensen is that later conduct is less important than the prior conduct.
All right.
It's Barris's burden to show a reasonable likelihood that the jury applied the Jensen instruction in an unconstitutional manner. All he has shown is that the jury most likely applied the jury instruction in a manner consistent with the law of Jensen. The correct application of the law to the facts cannot be an unconstitutional use of the instruction.
Well, suppose the court disagrees with you and says later conduct is just part of the facts and circumstances. You put it in the mix, that there's no weight given. That's for the jury.
Well, I think that in this case, if you decided that, in this case, there would be no reasonable likelihood that the jury would have applied the instruction in an unconstitutional manner. In other words, the jury would not have failed to force the state to bear the burden of utter disregard. It would not have precluded the jury from considering the remorse. Under the facts of this case, the jury would have considered all of the things that happened before the shooting, the hair trigger gun, the waving it around, the angry conduct in the apartment before shooting Kamal, putting the gun to Kamal's neck, then saying, oh, my God, shoot me, I didn't mean to do it, and then immediately after a minute of being sorry about what happened to Kamal, saying, I got to go, running from the scene, being on the lam for 4 months, and either keeping the gun or tossing it somewhere in the bushes to be found by some other person. So that if you look, if you adopt an equal weight analysis, I still think when you look at all of the facts in this case that the jury would have found utter disregard of human life. And I think that this is one of these cases where the defendant makes what might be a plausible argument of law for some other case, but it's not a plausible argument given the facts of his own case.
I have one more question. The supplemental jury instruction. Did that instruct the jury that the later conduct is less important? Did it instruct the jury that the later conduct is more important? Or did it instruct the jury to look at everything and they decide the weight? And when I say supplemental, I'm sorry. I mean the supplemental along with everything else that's given in the case. I don't want to isolate.
What we could call the Jensen instruction?
We can call it the Jensen instruction.
Yeah, okay. Well, the Jensen instruction did say that the later conduct should be considered or may be considered as one of the circumstances in the case.
So was it equal? Would you read that as equal? Greater? I mean, I want to understand, if you think the law is later conduct is less important, mm-hmm. Well, if they give it as equally important, then that's a wrong statement of the law. If you think the law is facts and circumstances for the jury, then is it the correct statement? I just want to know whether this instruction from Jensen, how it fits with your interpretation of what the present rule of law is.
Well, my interpretation of the instruction in Jensen are the same, because I think they're...
Same
they're,
as what?
As each other. Because the instruction is based on Jensen, and so Jensen is the law.
So what does Jensen say, your opinion?
Jensen says that after the fact regard for human life does not negate utter disregard otherwise established by the circumstances before and during the crime. Therefore, if you have, as you have in this case, utter disregard for human life established by Burris's conduct before the shooting and during the shooting, the later conduct can't negate that finding.
Isn't that holding tied to the argument in Jensen? Jensen was arguing that by calling 911, that later conduct good conduct of remorse or whatever, that later conduct negates mm-hmm. the other evidence of utter disregard. Mm-hmm. That's what the argument was. And so the Jensen court, it was a unanimous decision, so I say appropriately, you know, regardless whether it was a unanimous decision, it's the decision of the court, said no, later conduct does not negate mm-hmm. the earlier conduct, but rather it's a totality of the circumstances.
Yes, and I think that Jensen is very similar to this case in that you have this very substantial, I wish we had easier words to use, utterly disregarding conduct that created the injury to the child, and one small effort at, I would say there, something even better than remorse, attempt to assist the injured child. And this court held that Jensen's attempt to assist the injured child and staying with the injured child was not sufficient to preclude his injurious infliction of injury on the child before that. And I think that in this case, the, oh, my God, shoot me, is far less compelling than the Jensen's actions.
Well, Ms. Whalen, that concluding statement, and I'm going to be looking forward to discussing this topic with your opposing counsel as well. We're hearing phrases such as less important, whether after the fact conduct is less important or whether it should be assigned greater weight or less weight. It seems to me that there could be a very genuine concern that these are being discussed within the context of a legal conclusion, when really what we're talking about are factual determinations to be made by the jury. And when I look at the statute at hand prohibits one from recklessly causing great bodily harm to another human being under circumstances which show utter disregard for human life. That seems to be the central focus, the task for the jury. I think one reading of the statute could be the task for the jury would be to determine whether or not that occurred. And both pre-incident conduct and post-incident conduct can be considered by the jury. But what weight, if any, they wish to assign to any part of the timeline of the incidences, in the traditional viewpoint anyway, my reading of the law is that is the exclusive province of the jury.
Agreed. But I think since you're going back to the language of the statute, I think it's important to note that the statute doesn't say anything about considering after-the-fact conduct at all. I think that the court over the years could have interpreted this phrase to clearly only deal with before and during circumstances. But instead, the court has responded to arguments by defendants that my after-the-fact conduct should be considered. There has never been a case where a defendant has successfully convinced the court that the after-the-fact conduct means no utter disregard. So the court has...
There could be incidences, though, where juries across this state have made that determination.
Right. But what we know the law is based on what this court has said. And the law, as stated in Jensen, when this court instructed this jury, is that the after-the-fact conduct was not enough to preclude earlier conduct because it came later. This is how it distinguished Wagner and Balestrieri and distinguished them, the same with Holtz, without much concern that wasn't an obvious conclusion.
And one more question, which I'm also going to be asking your opposing counsel. If you had the opportunity to write the rule that comes out of this case, and if you could succinctly state that in a few sentences, what would that rule be?
Rule coming out of our case today?
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
For this case, I would just reiterate the language from Jensen, and I think that is sufficient for this case. However, and I think that what and I'm going to get to your question, I just want an aside, is, and I think
we
that...
We are well used to such detours in this room.
And I think that what the judge in this, the trial judge was obliged to do is, in this case, was instruct the jury on the law as it existed at that moment. However, I think that there certainly could be cases, because, you know, needless to say, I've thought a lot about this, where the defendant's after-the-fact conduct not only could, but really should be enough to negate a finding of utter disregard. That is not this case, and that's not any of the cases that we've seen in the appellate courts. So I think that the court might want to, if I were writing the rule, honestly, I would reiterate Jensen and say, however, we recognize that there might be cases in the future where the defendant's subsequent actions were so numerous or substantial that they would negate utter disregard. And this is why I think there's this idea of the sort of weight. And that's consistent with what I've argued in my brief, because I would be saying that those, if there is a quantity or a substantiality of later conduct, they would just weigh more heavily. And I can give some examples if you would like.
Who would make the determination of weight?
The jury. And I can give you an example.
Oh,
and
before you do that, in response to Justice
Kagan. No, your examples are numerous and well taken.
Oh, okay.
When he says, who would make the determination, I read that as another way of saying, how does the trial court instruct the jury? Does the trial court instruct the jury on the basis of the jury instructions now without the Jensen instruction? When the trial court thinks that there isn't evidence enough to negate utter disregard, that is, later conduct evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're suggesting? But that when the trial court believes that there is evidence of later conduct that does or maybe is enough to negate, then you give a special instruction? Do you know what I'm asking you?
Yeah. And no, I mean, in other words, would the trial court sort of be making an initial determination
that's
of weight? Yeah.
Chief Justice does recapture what I was getting at.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay.
And,
thank you.
Right.
Well, I think the answer to that has to be no. I don't think that the trial court would be making an initial determination of weight. And I think that if the
Then you need an instruction that says that the later conduct is given less weight. All the time, you need that instruction. If the trial judge is not going to be the gatekeeper, you've got to instruct the jury what the weight should be of before, during, and after. And that goes back to your original argument here that later conduct is less important.
Right. Well,
that
I think
jury weighs it.
I think that maybe a jury instruction could be later conduct is generally entitled to less weight than the conduct before and after. However, if you find that the defendants after the
it's
fact.
It's not before and after, it's before and
during. Thank you.
Okay.
And I made at least one mistake in my brief where I said after when I meant to say later, whatever. It gets confusing. But yeah, the jury instruction could say generally post-injury, let's say, post-injury conduct is entitled to less weight than the earlier conduct. However, if you find that the defendant's post-injury conduct was substantial and significant, you may find that that negates the prior utter disregard. But, of course, that's not this case. And I can give you a hypothetical.
Before you do that, I want to stop you at this point and get some clarification. You started out this morning by basically saying the state believes that under Jensen, after conduct is entitled to less weight than the conduct before or during a crime. Now, you're basing that on Jensen. And my first question to you is, what language from Jensen says that?
After the fact, regard for human life does not negate utter disregard otherwise established by the circumstances before and during the crime.
Continue on, though.
It may be considered by the fact finder as a part of the total factual picture, but it does not operate to preclude a finding of utter disregard for human life.
Now, you translate that into that it's entitled to lesser weight. Okay, how about some other language from Jensen? In paragraph 17, we said it can be and often is proven by evidence relating to the defendant's subjective state of mind by the defendant's statements, for example, before, during, and after the crime. That's paragraph 17. Mm-hmm. And then we also have language in paragraph 24. In evaluating the proof of utter disregard for human life, the fact finder is to consider all the factors relating to the conduct. Now, that says to me that we're talking about a totality of the circumstances situation, not that you draw the conclusion that it's entitled to less weight. I think it depends on the circumstances, how the trier of fact makes the determination. And the language that you're using, to me, doesn't say pure and simply that it's entitled to less weight than conduct before and during the crime. When you read Jansen as a whole, it seems to me Jansen says, hey, it depends on the circumstances. You look at the totality of the circumstances, and that the judge in this case, in answer to the jury's question, this is my opinion, could have pure and simply said yes, that they could consider it. That's what they were asking. Could they consider it? I just don't see where you're getting to this entitled to less weight. I don't think the language that you're citing us from paragraph 32 says it's entitled to less weight. It says it's entitled to be considered.
Two things. First of all, I'm reading 32 as the paragraph that concludes a section from 30 to 32 discussing Jensen's argument as it is based on Wagner and Balestrieri.
Right, and then you've got the case of State versus Miller,
right,
which comes from the Court of Appeals, which looks at Jensen, Wagner, and Balestrieri and comes to exactly the opposite conclusion than the one you're giving us.
Yes, I acknowledge that, and I think that footnote 12 in Miller was wrong. And I think also that it was unnecessary to the holding. And I really think that Miller actually, if you look at Miller, it supports the way I think the rule should be applied, because Miller, according as the majority opinion states the facts, the dissent sees it differently, but as the majority opinion states the facts, Mr. Miller was regardful of human life throughout the entire incident with Mr. Nakai.
Do you think that the state loses this case if we don't buy your argument that the after conduct is entitled to less weight than the conduct before and during a crime?
No, I don't think we lose the case, because I think that if you look at the totality of these circumstances, that there is substantial utter disregard throughout the incident from walking into the house with this very dangerous gun to being on the lam for 5 months. And one thing about his post-remorse conduct is that it really belies the deep sincerity of his minute of remorse. I mean, I believe that had some sincerity. I assume it had some sincerity. But I think it didn't go very deep, because if he was really concerned about what he did and about injuring his friend, he would have stuck around and he would have taken the consequences and at least tried to do something like stay with the victim.
Counsel, I'm not sure that I buy into this. We have to tell the jury what weight to give to before, during, and after evidence. I mean, what if, for example, after the fact, he exhibited the opposite of remorse? Couldn't the jury consider that to shore up the utter disregard at the time
yes,
of the event?
Which I think it could have done in this case with his post-remorse conduct. And that does tie in with something that I wanted to address that was raised in Burris's brief that I think that I did not adequately address in my reply brief, which is whether the way giving the after-the-fact conduct less weight can hurt the state in some cases, as it can hurt the defendant as it might hurt the defendant in some cases. And at first blush, I thought, well, obviously that's right. But on second consideration, I'm not willing to concede it just because, as I've tried to establish here, I'm really just relying on Jensen, and Jensen doesn't go that far. Jensen narrowly addresses the question, what does the defendant's after the fact remorse or calling 911 negate the utter disregard shown by the previous circumstances? I don't know whether a lot of post-conduct utter disregard should shore up what might be a marginal case for the state before enduring. I think that that's something that would have to be developed in another case. Counsel, I mean, again, it's not this case, I don't think.
Counsel, I hear some of the former circuit court judges, now this is my characterization, chomping at the bit with regard to this weight argument, because for years we have given the jury instruction that sounds something like this. You jurors are the sole judges of the credibility of the evidence and the weight to be given it. And that instruction is carried through in a couple of cases. Fisher comes to mind, Bauer, that says weight is for the jury to determine. And whether it's a civil or a criminal case, you jurors are the sole judges. So how can your weight argument comport with that instruction and the cases applying that?
Well, I guess I just see that under Jensen, if the jury had given this moment of remorse equal weight with everything that happened before, and if they thought, okay, reasonable doubt because it's, you know, we're weighing this equally, that the jury would have reached an unreasonable and incorrect result in this case, because I think this case, with or without this jury instruction, clearly shows utter disregard. And I think I didn't answer someone's question, if I could just finish, about whether yes would have been the right answer to the jury's question. And I think that I think probably that would have been okay. And I say in my brief that I think that would have been fine, but that doesn't mean the court had to do it. But there is a possibility that if the court had just answered yes, that the jury would have allowed that 1 minute of remorse to overwhelm all the other circumstances. I don't think it would have, but it might have. So maybe yes would have been a bad answer.
Thank you, Ms. I'm sorry, are there any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Whalen. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Byron C. Lichtstein of the Franklin J. Remington Center of the University of Wisconsin Law School, arguing on behalf of Mr. Burris.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court. I am Byron C. Lichtstein, and I appear on behalf of Mr. Burris. I'm also pleased today to have with me a law student, an excellent law student named Hannah Schieber, and I appreciate the Court and the Marshal allowing Ms. Schieber to sit with me at council table today.
We're delighted to have her. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The State is asking you to write an opinion in this case, as I hear them today and in their brief, that would essentially say, after the fact conduct, in all cases, no matter the facts, it's entitled to less weight. That is a dramatic departure from the typical way that juries make decisions in utter disregard cases. Now, the State does not acknowledge that that rule would have dramatic consequences, but when you look at how it would be applied, it's quite clear that it would, and I think the Court's questions today make that very clear. There is simply no other way to have such a rule but to also have a jury instruction where the judge directly comments and instructs the jury on what weight to give to a particular category of evidence. Now, I cannot think of another example, a situation where the judge directly weighs in and comments on what weight to give to evidence. As you're well aware and as your questions indicate, that is the province of the jury. What weight to give to evidence, the jury makes that decision. The judge deals with issues of admissibility and issues of law. The jury is the sole fact finder, and they decide what weight.
Counsel, the charging document in this case charged what? It must have, usually they say, on this date, in this county, in this state, this defendant did this, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Utter disregard for human life in this instance, right? So the jury is called upon to decide if on that date, at that place, that defendant had utter disregard for human life, right?
Right.
Now, the totality of the circumstances may be that the jury should know what happened then, what happened on that date, and what happened afterwards. But can what someone does afterwards negate or undo the utter disregard for human life at the date and time and place charged in the complaint? I mean, the statute itself talks about utter disregard for human life at that date, at that time, at that place. Can you, a day or two or a month later, undo that charge? Is that what the statute's intended to be by, you know, in Jensen, by allowing in all the facts for the jury to consider? I mean, if someone's really, really remorseful, can they undo the fact that they had utter disregard for human life on the date and place charged?
Your Honor, I don't think the totality of the circumstances analysis calls for a two-stage analysis of was there utter disregard before and during, and only then do you consider the conduct after the fact. Totality of the circumstances is, as I understand it, as it sounds, consider all the conduct together, everything.
Tell the jury what happened. Right?
Yes. Before, during, and after. And the jury considers all that together, and they make a determination about whether they believe there was utter disregard for human life, and we ought to trust them to consider all the circumstances together. That's the way it's been done, as far as I can tell, up until now, and I don't see that there's any reason to change that. And if you look at other areas of the law where we have a totality of the circumstances analysis, this Court recently did an opinion in a case called Grady, I believe last term in a Miranda context, U.S. Supreme Court law in the Fourth Amendment context, in Illinois versus Gates. These are totality of the circumstances analyses. And what the courts have said, this Court and the U.S. Supreme Court, what they've said is, we don't want inflexible, bright-line rules in this area. Totality of the circumstances just isn't what that is about. This Court said in Grady, we prefer a flexible approach that examines all relevant facts. We don't believe a bright-line rule is necessary or even desirable. The State agrees this is a totality of the circumstances analysis, but they want you to build a bright-line rule into that analysis. That's inconsistent with previous case law about what a totality of the circumstances analysis is.
So if someone's really, really remorseful afterwards, can it undo the fact that they were waving a gun around, drinking beer, sitting on the couch, pointing it at people, thinking it was unloaded, but it really was loaded? I mean, if they're really sorry about doing that, does that mean they didn't engage in utter disregard for human life?
Your Honor, I think there are many cases where the after-the-fact conduct will be very significant in determining whether there is utter disregard for human life. And one of the examples that we gave in our brief has to do with this hypothetical that we adapted from this tragic incident in Wisconsin Dells, where a rider at an amusement park goes up to the top of a tower. It's a ride where you plunge from the top to the bottom in free fall, and the attendant fails to raise the safety net. Now, certainly that's negligent behavior on its face. Is it reckless? Does it show utter disregard for human life? Well, if you know that right after that the attendant looks at what happened and has an extraordinarily callous reaction, laughs about it, jokes about it, I think it's common sense that that says a great deal about whether the circumstances viewed as a whole reflect utter disregard for human life, and why you would want to have a rule in that case where the defendant gets to have the jury instructed that after-the-fact conduct is necessarily entitled to less weight than the other conduct. Why would you want to have such a rule in that case? Now, the state's indicated today that somehow perhaps the rule would only apply in situations where the conduct after the fact is aggravating. I just don't see how you could do that. If you're going to write an opinion that says after the fact conduct is entitled to less weight, that's going to apply across the board, and sometimes it certainly is going to harm the state's case. Other times it will harm the defendant's case. But the point is, sometimes what happens after says a great deal about whether there's utter disregard for human life. And there's no reason to have a flat legal rule that says otherwise for all cases.
Counsel, I want to follow up on Justice Ziegler's question and to make sure it's clear what your argument is. On page 30 of the state's brief, the state characterizes your argument. And on the bottom paragraph on page 30, the state says, the theory of Burris's defense was that his fleeting expression of remorse was sufficient to wash away all the acts of utter disregard for human life he demonstrated before and during the reckless infliction of Kamal's injury. In other words, he wanted the jury to conclude that this conduct negated, quotation marks, or precluded, quotation marks, a legal finding of utter disregard. I assume the quotation marks were because those are the words that was used in Jensen. Is that your argument? Does the state correctly characterize your argument?
Not exactly, Your Honor. This is not a sufficiency of evidence case, as you well know. And as Your Honor pointed out, the question here is that the state is arguing, as we've heard them earlier today, that essentially there's no way that what happened after the fact here could wash away or undo what happened before. It's important to look at what actually happened in this trial. This jury asked about after the fact conduct not once, but twice. And what we know from that is that this jury thought the after-the-fact conduct was important. Now, the state wants to retry the facts. They want to pretend as if that significant fact that the jury cared about this after-the-fact conduct, that it somehow isn't there and that we should ignore that and conclude that, well, there's no possible way the after-the-fact conduct could have mattered. But we know it did matter to the jury. And we also know, and there's reason to understand why it mattered to the jury, and that's another point of disagreement between us and the state, and that is that the state takes a view of the facts that's very black and white, as if the jury must necessarily have accepted the trial testimony of the state's witnesses. The state simply is omitting the fact that all three of those witnesses gave significantly different statements to police, and that is very likely, at least reasonably likely, why the jury was interested in the after-the-fact conduct. Because it was undisputed. Everybody agreed about it. So the jury, unsure of what happened before and during the event, is very likely wondering, well, what weight can we give these undisputed facts that happened after the crime? What weight can we give them? And that instruction, I would submit, essentially tells the jury, as the Court of Appeals concluded, that the after-the-fact conduct is not important or cannot tip the balance toward or away from utter disregard for human life. And I think it's important to look specifically at the exact language of the judge's answer to the question to understand why it communicates that impression.
Can you draw our attention to that? I think it's in the petitioner's appendix 131, around that area. No, I'm sorry. It starts there. So we can look at it. Or someplace else.
Your Honor, I see Petitioner Appendix 109 is the language from Jensen that the court included.
Are you arguing that if the jury instruction said after-fact conduct is less weight, are you arguing that is an incorrect statement of the law? Or are you arguing it's a correct statement but misleading?
I believe it's an incorrect statement of the law to say that after-the-fact conduct is necessarily, in all cases, entitled to less weight.
And that's how you read that Jensen instruction.
I view the Jensen decision I have no gripe with. It's correct for what it is. It's a fact-specific sufficiency of the evidence case where the court concluded that an act of regard after a crime wasn't enough to, as a matter of law, prohibit the jury from finding utter disregard for human life. In that case, that certainly seems to me there's nothing incorrect about that. My problem is that fact-specific holding certainly does not mean that for all cases, when we're talking about fact-finding, the jury's fact-finding in the first instance, there's no reason to take that language from Jensen and carry that over and create this rule for all fact-finding and utter disregard cases.
I'm sorry to have interrupted, but back to Justice Bradley's reference to the appendix.
It's the language, you said 109?
I believe so, Your Honor.
If you're going to be reading it, I want to focus on it. Okay, yeah, that's part of the Court of Appeals opinion.
Right.
Okay. I have the full text right in front of me, and it includes this language from Jensen. So the court said, and in response to this question, if this clarifies anything, after the fact regard for human life does not negate utter disregard otherwise established by the circumstances before and during the crime, it may be considered by the fact finder as a part of the total factual picture, but it does not operate to preclude a finding of utter disregard for human life. So what we essentially have is a negative statement, followed by a positive statement, followed by another negative statement. And I would submit to you that what the lay person probably hears from that instruction, the question is, can we consider after the fact conduct? What they probably hear is, no, not really, yes, kind of, but no, not really. And being told that, what is the lay jury going to think? Most likely they're going to think it's not important, it's less significant, or at the very least, it can't be the deciding factor. It can't tip the balance toward or away from a finding of utter disregard.
Mr. Lichtenstein, what do you think the trial court should have done here in response to the jury's questions?
Your Honor, I think there are a number of responses that would have been correct. One would have been to just answer the question, yes. Yes, you may consider after-the-fact conduct. Another would have been to just refer back to the totality of the circumstances instruction. And probably there are other more similar instructions to either of those two that would have been acceptable from my point of view.
Now, I understand that the defense has the burden in regard to this particular situation. When you're attempting to establish that there's a due process violation because there was a reasonable likelihood that the jury applied the supplemental jury instruction in an unconstitutional manner. Doesn't that seem to ignore part of what the judge gave when he says it may be considered by the fact finder as part of the total factual picture? Isn't that a totality of the circumstances instruction?
Well, Your Honor, as I've indicated, I think what that instruction says, if you had just read that one sentence, we'd have a different situation. But we have that one sentence sandwiched in between these two negative statements. And I think what the jury probably hears from that, can we consider after-the-fact conduct? No, not really. Yes, kind of. But no, not really. So I certainly concede that buried within that is the language, it may be considered. But in the context of everything else around that, that isn't the clear message the jury is going to take from that answer to the question.
Well, counsel, isn't that sort of underscoring a tension that's being clarified or revealed, at least by the process of this conversation? When we look at the language in Jensen that we were talking about in paragraph 32, it's preceded by two paragraphs discussing Balestrieri and Wagner, and those two paragraphs specifically distinguish those two cases as where the defendant took measures before the incident to try to avoid the injury. And then we get into the questions from Justice Ziegler that more explicitly point out the tension, and it runs back to the question I asked Ms. Whalen about the plain language of the statute. And that is, really, it seems to me that the real question is, can after the fact, can post-conduct behavior, I don't know that I like the word negate, but because I can't think of a better one in this context, I'm open to suggestions, because I can't think of a better one, I'll use it. Can post reckless conduct undertaken under circumstances with utter disregard for human life ever negate that conduct?
Well, I guess I would agree with your sentiment that I don't like the term negate or preclude, because I think that implies that there's a two-stage fact-finding process, that the jury looks at the before and during conduct, makes a decision on that, and then considers whether the stuff after the fact negates or precludes. And I don't think that's really what totality of the circumstances is about. But
the larger question.
The larger question, I think, is, as I tried to indicate, I apologize if it wasn't clear in answering Justice Ziegler, I think that there are many cases where after-the-fact conduct is very, very significant.
I heard you, because then you used the Wisconsin Dells incident, and also I enjoyed reading your good hypotheticals in the brief, one regarding the one or two shakes of the baby, followed by, you know, callous comments under your hypothetical. And they did a very good job of sort of underscoring the consequences of certain options available to this court for a rule to be articulated. But isn't that really the question? And I guess I don't want to, if you can answer it yes or no, I guess I would appreciate that. If you can't, then you can't.
And the yes or no is, can after-the-fact conduct ever make the difference?
Well, can it ever negate yes, that is the question.
I would say yes.
Okay.
Certainly there are cases where after-the-fact conduct is significant enough to tip the balance.
And that goes to then the question for the jury, because as I discussed with Ms. Whalen, there might be any number of cases around this state where juries have decided, they've looked at the totality of the circumstances, they've considered, as the Jensen case says, the factual picture clarified by post-incident conduct, that the jury would make that determination. And so there might be any number of times where juries have looked at after-incident conduct and said, yes, that negates it. But here we have an odd mix, it seems to me. We, the seven of us, are being presented with a question of law, and I'm trying to determine for myself how is it we are going to articulate the law, not particularly, I mean, of course we are very, very concerned with the grave circumstances of this case, but for future cases and to be consistent therewith. That's what I'm struggling with.
Well, Your Honor, I think the answer to that question from my perspective is the opinion in this case needs to say nothing more than utter disregard for human life is a totality of the circumstances analysis. Considered within that analysis is conduct occurring before, during, and after. It's the jury's job to give what weight it will to the different circumstances in the case and to assess holistically whether there's utter disregard for human life. To me, that's fully consistent with what the law has said previously and what totality of the circumstances typically is, and you don't need to do anything dramatic to change the law. I think this would be a dramatic change, and I think it would require quite dramatic consequences as far as jury instructions.
I think one of the reasons for the struggle is that I'd be hard-pressed to say that the trial court judge inaccurately recited the holding from Jensen.
I would agree with you. As I said, I have no complaint about the correctness of Jensen for what it was. It was a sufficiency of evidence, fact-specific case. I'm not in any way asking you to overrule Jensen. Jensen is a perfectly good holding. It just doesn't support the premise that the state is asking you to adopt here, which is that in every case, all the time, after-the-fact conduct necessarily is entitled to less weight. I don't think the language of the case says that. And further, I don't think that's a good idea for reasons I've
also
already
made. I'd like to move you to the second issue a little bit, since we've been talking about the first one mostly. Let's assume the jury follows the instructions given. We have tons of case law that says that. So let's assume they heard what the judge read and they did what the instruction says. Given the conduct in this case where a man puts a loaded revolver to the neck of someone else and pulls the trigger, why do you think it's, what's your best argument, that it's reasonably likely or there's a reasonable likelihood that the jury applied the supplemental instruction in an unconstitutional manner?
Your Honor, if that's what the jury had believed happened, if they had believed the trial testimony of the state's witnesses, that the defendant from point-blank range raised the gun, deliberately pulled the trigger, there's no way they even get to the after-the-fact conduct. There's no reason to believe that's what the jury thought happened. Because why would they be considering whether there's utter disregard for human life? It's obvious under those circumstances, and there's a case cited in my brief that says that. So my main response is, I don't think that's a reasonable assumption about what the jury thought happened. That's what the state has tried to suggest. But there's no reason to believe the jury would have even cared about the after-the-fact conduct if they thought he deliberately shot a man in the neck from point-blank range. How could that be anything but utter disregard for human life? What's much more likely is that they thought the state's witnesses were impeached and they had Mr. Burris's testimony describing essentially an accident.
Well, did the counsel argue that after-the-fact testimony showed that there was here not conduct regardless of life? Wasn't that counsel's argument in closing, that you should look at what happened later?
Well, the argument was twofold. It was that, first of all, the state's witnesses have been significantly impeached by various cross-examination. But, yes, when you consider that together with what happened afterwards, it tips the balance away from first-degree reckless.
Right. So he was arguing that the jury ought to consider that. And so the jury asked a question, can we consider that? And the judge read him an instruction. I mean, I read the testimony perhaps a little bit different than argued here, and I think the first question is very significant and very interesting. But frankly, I'm as interested in the second part of the test, which is whether there was a reasonable likelihood, given what went on here, that they applied it in an unconstitutional fashion.
Well, Your Honor, I think, as I've indicated, I think you have to ask yourselves, I believe, why did the jury twice ask about the after-the-fact conduct?
That's what counsel argued. You should consider what he did after the fact, as well as arguing that he didn't do things exactly as other folks said. But counsel, wasn't counsel arguing, you know, he even said he would kill himself. He, you know, that there he was very remorseful. So the jury is thinking, well, can we consider that or not consider that? Well, who do you ask? You ask the judge if you have a question.
I guess I simply don't think that a reasonable juror who believes, as I said before, that Mr. Burris held the gun up from point-blank range, deliberately pulled the trigger, I can't imagine how the jury would pause about whether that shows utter disregard for human life.
Well, if they're listening to what goes on in court, they know that there are two sides of it. The judge always instructs them not to make up their mind until the case is all finished. And these are not, you know, legal professionals that sit on this jury. I mean, they hear what both sides argue, and they're trying to figure out what are they supposed to do, and the judge gives them the law. So, I don't know. I didn't find the question all that odd. But so you're saying if they believe the other side, you don't think that they would ever ask the question?
That's right.
I guess I just don't read the record in line with that. I mean, I think the jury listens to counsel's argument. That's what counsel argued. So they ask the judge, can we consider it or not consider it, you know? Look at the totality of the circumstances. It doesn't negate the conduct before, but it is part of the totality of the circumstances.
Thank you. I apologize for interrupting you there.
It's okay.
I think there's one other answer to your question,
which
is that argument that the state has made is basically a harmless error argument. And there is direct language in Lohmeyer that says harmless error doesn't apply in this situation.
The test I was trying to say to you is Lohmann's test. Lohmann, or Lorimer, I think it is, Lohmeier.
Lohmeyer. And the test we set out is whether there was a reasonable likelihood that the jury applied the supplemental instruction in an unconstitutional manner. So that's what I was looking at, and I started out with our law, which always says the jury always follows or is presumed to follow the instruction of the court on the law, unless you got something else that's going to disturb that. And then I looked at what went on here, what the facts were, and what counsel argued, and tried to figure out, well, you know, is there a reasonable likelihood? And I think your argument is a very interesting argument. I just think juries listen. They try really hard to do the right thing, and they had a question, so they asked the judge the question.
Well, I guess my last point on that will just be that I think the factual scenario here was much more difficult than the state's assessment reveals, and that really the facts about what happened before and during were quite gray. And given that, it makes sense to me that the jury was struggling with how much weight, whether to weigh,
sure,
conduct after,
sure,
the fact.
Sure.
Do you see that my light is on, Justice Prosser? I think you,
yeah,
were.
A little earlier in your argument, you cited the language on page 109 of the appendix. I was looking, and of course, following that indented quotation, there is another sentence. So the whole thing appears on page 14 of the red brief. What is the meaning of that last sentence that was given to the jury, in your opinion?
The last sentence, meaning the element of utter disregard for human life is measured objectively,
yep,
on the basis of what a reasonable person in the defendant's position would have known. Well, I read that as just indicating that the utter disregard element is an objective standard, meaning that you look at all the circumstances and determine whether they reflect utter disregard for human life. That's really all I interpret that to mean.
Well, let's say a defendant did something 24 hours after an incident and really did something quite remarkable and just wonderful 24 hours after the incident. Does that really square with that last sentence?
Your Honor, I think it does. I don't read anything in that language that says anything about the fact that something that occurs well after would be excluded from the analysis. And I think... So I don't read that language as excluding that, and I think that's consistent with the view I've articulated earlier, which is that I think the totality of the circumstances test is holistic.
Well, let me ask this. The Court of Appeals talks about the question posed by the jury and said that the answer yes would have been fine. Why wouldn't that have been somewhat misleading?
The answer yes?
Yeah.
Because... question was, can we consider what the conduct after the fact? And I believe the correct answer to that is simply yes, that the jury can. That you can consider what happened after the fact. And that's fully consistent with the pattern instruction.
Can they consider it in every conceivable way?
Well,
I mean, can post-incident conduct and attitudes simply wipe out the utter disregard?
Well, but that wasn't the question the jury asked. They didn't ask. They didn't say to the judge, we think there's utter disregard from what happened before and during, and we want to know, does what happened after wash it away? My light is on. May I continue?
You may, counsel.
They didn't ask that question. They didn't ask whether what happened after the fact washes away a finding they already made. They just said a simple question. Can we consider it? To me, the plain common sense answer to that is yes, you can consider it. They weren't in any way indicating that they were doing some kind of analysis where they were going to allow what happened after the fact to wash away the finding of before and during. I don't think there's any reason to believe that's what the jury was doing.
Counsel, I have a question for you. What we are looking at, as I understand it, is the state of mind at the time of the incident, right? Utter disregard. Right?
The circumstances existing, whether they reflect utter disregard.
Okay, but we're trying to find out if the defendant had utter disregard, right?
Yes.
That's what we're trying to do. And it's utter disregard at the time the gun was pulled, the trigger was pulled, right? I mean, that's what we're looking for.
We are assessing the state of mind at the time of the crime.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, this whole conversation has been on conduct after. But it seems to me, if you don't look at conduct after, how can you look at conduct before? This whole argument should be before and after.
I think
because it seems to me you should apply the same rules. The guy may have had utter disregard or may have indicated utter disregard before. But that's sort of irrelevant unless you look at the totality of the circumstances to what he did then, because he could have changed his mind. So it seems to me the question is, whatever, if the court should do anything other than totality of the circumstances, whatever it says about after the fact, 1 minute after the fact, should apply to 1 minute before the fact.
I'll be very brief. I think you're correct, Your Honor.
Well, I hoped you'd say that.
It's really complex. Some cases, the before and during is going to be the most significant. In some cases, what happens after is. And there's no reason to make flat rules for all cases, because the flat rule likely isn't going to fit some of those cases.
I'm going to go back to another question I asked you earlier. Now, the language pulled from Jensen in the jury instructions, unanimous opinion, it's there, it's correct. So one could argue that's a correct statement of the law. But it's taken, of course, out of context, and Justice Crooks read you other language from the case. Seems to me your argument is either pulled out of context, it's incorrect, or more likely, as I read your brief, that it's correct law but misleading, and that you then apply the reasonable likelihood standard, or the due process standard. And then it seems to me that regardless of what counsel argued, if the jury is instructed, you can't give weight, or you have to give less weight to after the fact, that is misleading to the jury, according to you. And therefore, regardless of what counsel argued, and counsel's argument is not evidence, right?
Right.
The jury is so instructed, or should have been, right? So it seems to me that is your argument about why, if it's misleading, there's no reasonable likelihood, or there's and therefore that it's error. Now, where have I gone wrong?
I don't think you've gone wrong anywhere. I think you've put your finger on perhaps an ambiguity in the relationship between legally incorrect and misleading. As you've quite rightly pointed out, my position is that the Jensen language is correct for that context, which I think, in my opinion, makes it misleading for a different and inappropriate context.
And taken out of context. Okay. Before you sit down, this will be also asked of Ms. Whalen. An issue that's outstanding in this case is what to do with the other issues in the case that defense counsel raised before the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals need not have responded to those issues because they held in favor of the defendant on one issue, right? Okay. The other issues, as I understand them, are did the trial court err in allowing the state to cross-examine Burris and to present rebuttal evidence on an irrelevant issue. This is the cross-examination and rebuttal. Did the trial counsel provide ineffective assistance in several ways? And was Burris entitled to a new trial in the interest of justice? Are those the issues? And if you can't locate that, this is sort of a surprise question. You know, you can sit down and look at it, and we can do that. But are those the questions remaining?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. And it's my understanding, did you brief those in the Court of Appeals? I have the briefs, but I didn't look at them.
We did.
Okay. But not here.
Correct.
As you both agreed. And so should the decision on this issue go against you, it's my understanding you want this case to go back to the Court of Appeals to decide the issues that you raised there.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And that's still your position?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask that of Ms. Whalen.
Mr. Lichtenstein,
sorry.
I do have another
Justice
question.
Justice Prosser.
Second-degree reckless injury. Whoever recklessly causes great bodily harm to another human being is guilty of a Class F felony. Can you consider evidence after an incident that is absolutely deplorable, disgusting, egregious, and shocking to elevate the crime into a Class D felony, utter disregard?
I think absolutely. Our position is that what occurs after the fact is part of the totality of the circumstances analysis and can be the basis for a finding of utter disregard in some cases.
You're going to get stuck, counsel, I think. On
after facts, I can't imagine you making that argument.
I guess I misunderstood the question. What I understood you to ask is, can deplorable bad conduct after the injury, can that be considered in determining whether there's utter disregard for human life? Am I correct that that was your question?
If there is a shooting, and it's a reckless shooting, let's say I shoot you. I'm reckless about it. After I shoot you, if I turn to Justice Ziegler and start saying really stupid, terrible things, does it go up to utter disregard?
It depends on what the other facts are, but I think the jury certainly can consider that.
This was charged both as a first degree and second degree. Is that correct?
I have to say I can't remember.
Well, that's what the facts are. The jury was instructed on both first degree and second degree, as I understood it.
That's correct. That's why there was a fight over.
And if they weren't charged with the higher offense, then even if the evidence showed that, there'd be a question as to whether or not the jury can so find. And then there's another issue of lesser included. So I don't know which way Justice Prosser is moving, up from the charged, down from the charged, or assuming both charges, both offenses were charged.
First degree reckless injury while armed and felon in possession of a firearm. And those are the two charges for which he was convicted.
Correct. And there was a lesser included offense submitted. I guess maybe I'm missing the import of your question, but my basic position is after the fact conduct is part of the totality of the circumstances test, meaning in the right case it can tip the balance toward or away from
guilt,
disregard.
From guilt on the charged offense.
Right, yes.
All right.
Just for clarification, the facts are, I think he was charged for first degree and the firearm possession, but he was instructed by the jury was instructed as to both first degree and second degree reckless.
As a lesser included. That's what I would assume.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Wait, Justice Prosser, do you want to ask any questions?
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Whalen?
Oh, wait, just one thing. In about a few seconds, assuming everything is functioning the way it ordinarily does in the building, which is a huge assumption, a fire alarm will go off, which is ordinarily, but not always, loud and annoying. And if it does go off, and if it's of that tenor, we'll just stop and sit quietly. Okay? Thank you. So do not be surprised if it goes off. You may proceed. First, would you mind responding?
Yeah, I don't have my green light yet, so I don't want to cheat. Okay.
Okay.
Or my yellow light. Yeah, the first question on the procedural question, I think that really what Mr. Lichtstein was asking for in his motion was a remand to the Court of Appeals, which is I had no objection to, and I think is actually just what happened under the rules.
Well, the rules aren't clear, but ordinarily if you don't brief it and you ask for it to go back, the court will send it back. You can brief all these issues here and ask this court to do it so you don't have a ping-pong kind of effect. The court might grant that and might send it back. If it sends it back, I have a standard concurrence that says I disagree. But okay, that's what usually happens.
Okay. All right. Okay. In the Chief Justice's last or substantive question, maybe your last question, in asking about the reasonable likelihood argument, you made the comment or the phrase that regardless of counsel's closing argument, dot, 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 and I don't remember if it's Lohmeyer or Avila, but one of those two cases says that when you're assessing whether a legally correct jury instruction was misleading under the reasonable likelihood test, one of the things you consider is counsel's argument. You look at the whole case. So
I agree with that.
Then I misunderstood.
And if I gave you the wrong impression, not. It's just that in light of counsel's argument, that question may have been asked. And if the answer was give it less weight or give it no weight, then we got a problem.
Mm-hmm. Though I do think that the fact that Mr. Burris in his testimony emphasized his remorse and that counsel in his closing argument, and I quote that in my brief, emphasized remorse, I do think that that's why the jury was asking about it. I don't think that this means the jury was confused. Also, I think we shouldn't assume that maybe the jury wasn't interested in the other after-the-fact conduct. And also, this emphasis on the jury asked twice, I mean, the jury asked the question, the court discussed the answer, and as the court was about to give the answer, they asked, you know, answer our question, please. I think that this, they asked twice, is a little overplayed. I also wanted to talk about the facts just for a minute. I think I've thoroughly, in my reply brief, responded to what the opposing counsel describes as the significant impeachment of the Rashada's testimony, and I'm not going to go through that anymore. But I just, in reviewing Donovan Barris's version of the facts, what happened is he's there with the gun in his hand, and Kamal comes up to him from behind and grabs his arm, and that somehow in this situation, Barris manages to shoot the guy behind him in the neck. And I would just, I just think that it is just so improbable that that could have happened. And as Assistant DA Potter, and this is quoted in the brief, he says, you know, how did that, you know, happen exactly? It's just very, very improbable.
Ms. Whalen, while you're taking a breath, you think there are different rules for before the incident and after the incident?
That is a great question that I have to say I gave no, never crossed my mind. You're welcome. Not unusual. But I think that the question is actually answered by Wagner and Balestrieri, because there, those were both car accidents. And in both of those cases, before hitting the pedestrians, the driver swerved or otherwise took due care to try to minimize the accidents, although unsuccessfully. So I think in Wagner and Balestrieri, the court has already acknowledged the importance of before the injury conduct.
The question is still good.
Well, I think so, yeah. Because I think that one of the things underlying the question, or maybe the key point underlying the question, is that the focus really has to be on the actual infliction of the injury. That is the thing that is most important.
That's right. And what you're doing on both the prior and subsequent events or circumstances or conduct is to try and figure out how that plays to determine the actual event.
And also, I think, Your Honor, you were framing it, and I'll just finish this sentence, I'm sorry, that what the issue is the defendant's state of mind. And that really is why we're looking at totality of circumstances, is to determine the defendant's state of mind when he, in this case, pulled the trigger.
Right. At that moment.
Yeah.
Back and forth. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Okay. Whelan. Thank you, Mr. Lichtenstein, and your assistant. And thank you all for making the effort to come today to court. We do appreciate it. And with that, and apparently, as I said, things are not as usual today. The alarm did not go off, and that's good. Now I worry about whether they're working, so should there be an incident, whether we're all protected. So there's no winning in this situation for me. And that concludes our argument on 09-AP-956-CR, State versus Donovan and Burris. And thank you both for excellent arguments and briefs. We conclude that, and we're going to take a short break at the request of a justice. All right.